Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad you could join me for a little bit of cardboard conversation. No, the conversation isn't dull and boring and stiff as cardboard. At least I don't think it is. Am I giving myself a complex here? I don't want to do that. No, we're conversing about cardboard. Of course, talking about some classic baseball cards, vintage sets, and of course, my favorite, a lot of the junk wax that we all grew up with. And we're not talking about junk wax in particular today. No, actually, a listener suggestion, and one of many great suggestions from the listener. I'll share his email or his comments with me in just a few minutes, but we will be talking about the 75 Topps mini set. A very intriguing set. It's got a weird history behind it. The legacy it leaves is also kind of weird. And there are a lot of unanswered questions, some that I will answer after doing a little research on it. And it was such a great suggestion from our listener that I went into my collection and I have 275 Topps mini cards. And I bought them a long, long time ago. And I have no idea why I bought them. It's the strangest thing. You know, I can remember the littlest details of so many of my card acquisitions over 30 years of collecting. But I can't remember this one for whatever reason. So we'll talk about 75 Topps Mini. We'll talk about the two particular players that I have mini cards of. One of the most underrated ball players of modern baseball history. In fact, Bill James calls him, without a doubt, the number one most underrated player. Darrell Evans, pictured with the Atlanta Braves in 1975, and one of the underrated pitchers. He often gets overlooked when you talk about pitchers who had a handful of dominant seasons but was part of a winning team. Talking about Jerry Kuzman, famous for his time with the Mets in the late 60s and early 70s. Great story about how the Mets almost let him go before his career got started. And you won't believe the reason why they decided to keep him when he was a youngster. But if you're a Mets fan, you might actually believe the reason, because it's all about saving a few dollars. Yes, believe it or not, there is a complex personal financial detail to why the Mets hung on to Jerry Kuzman in the mid-1960s. Now, before we get to all of that, plus some great comments from our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, I just want to remind you that Wax Ecstatic comes your way throughout the off-season every other Friday. And I'm going to make an executive decision on the show right now. We're going to keep it every other Friday, even as the season gets underway here in just a few weeks. The show, I found it's been a lot easier for me to record and produce on an every other week basis. And also based on your comments, as well as just looking at statistics of podcast listening for this program, it seems like every other week works for you as well. And I know we've got some fans who are huge, huge supporters of the program, and I thank you, and you listen every time we put a show out, and you listen from start to finish, and that's great. But for the most part, most listeners, even though the show comes out every other Friday, they might get around to it the following Tuesday or Wednesday. And then they'll, maybe in two or three parts, they'll listen to the whole show. So it's not only a good pace for me to put it all together and send it out, but I've discovered it's a good pace for you to consume it. So we're going to keep that going. So go ahead and set your calendars, if you will. Every other Friday, moving on forward, even in through this upcoming 2019 baseball season, we will be sending a show out to you. And if we do a show where we are either looking at specific cards or we're opening up packs, we will do that the day before, so the Thursday prior to the release of the podcast, which comes out at noon Eastern on that every other Friday. So that means our next podcast will be 2 weeks from today. That will be Friday, February the 22nd. Now, we had a lot of great comments on our Twitter timeline for Wax Ecstatic. It is Wax and Gum Stains. If you don't follow already, please do. tell your friends about it as well, as they can check it out. And of all the comments and some DMs that I got, one of the best ones, and I saw a pretty good reaction to this, came from our listener, Gord Tepp, and he sends a picture. It's two gentlemen opening up a box of new tops, the 2019 Series 1, and it looks like they're doing it at the kitchen table here. And Gord explains, opening a brand new box of Topps baseball cards for the first time in decades with my dad made for one of the best Saturday afternoons in recent memory. It felt like we hopped in the DeLorean and went back 30 years. Life is good. Well, thank you so much for sharing that story and that picture, Gord. And one of the replies that we got came from Barbara Tepper, who just, you know, putting two and two together here, I'm assuming Barbara is related somehow to Gord. And she says, it was a wonderful day. Now, if only there were still baseball card shows we could go to for fun. Well, first of all, Barbara, yeah, amen. It reminded me of the thrill of opening up new baseball cards. And it's the thrill that I experience, I know our listeners experienced, every late February, or, you know, now, you know, they kind of moved the release dates back a little bit. Now you're looking at late January, early February. But I remember, you know, mid to late February, the new line of cards would come out. And that's when you went to the hobby shops. You know, you didn't always see them in the grocery stores first. You'd go to the hobby shop and you'd pick up a few packs, or, you know, if you had a little extra money in your pocket and you planned right, you'd be able to afford a whole box or a whole stack of rack packs or whatever. And just opening them and just seeing the new designs and, you know, seeing your favorite players, some of them maybe wearing new uniforms, or, you know, before the days of the internet, this was somehow the way that you saw a new team logo or a new stadium or something like that. And it was always fun. And, you know, if you go back far enough to where they put bubble gum in the packs, you know, the gum was actually kind of sort of edible. You know, it wasn't crumbling on your tongue, you know, midway through the season because it had been sitting in that pack of cards for 6 months. So a lot of great memories for me, too. And especially with the release of Series 1 of Topps, I know we're talking classic cards here on this program, but I've got to tell you, I love the new 2019 Topps base set. Love, 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 love. And I'm going to have to be very prudent about my spending, because it's one of those sets where I could see myself every time I'm walking into Walmart or Target walking off with a box of these, and that could put a little dent in the budget. So I've got to be careful with myself. Also, you know, I want to make sure that I'm ready for the Topps Heritage release. As you know, Topps Heritage is my favorite current set, and has been for a very long time now, a good 10, 12 years now I've been collecting it. And this year, Topps Heritage will be reflective of the 1970 set, so I'm looking forward to that. But as for the base set, even if you don't normally collect the new cards, I would strongly suggest go out and buy a couple packs of the new Topps set. And I'm going to drop in a hint as to why you will like the set. And that hint is 1982. If you look closely at the new Topps cards, if you squint just a little bit, there's a lot of 1982 Topps in the design for 2019. Basically, the classic curvy hockey stick motif, as we like to call it, the lines that in the 82 Topps ran down the left side, curved into the lower left corner. You've got a lot of that design element, except it's on the right side of the card for 2019 Topps. Now, that's not to say Topps just ripped off the design. And sometimes card companies will do that. They'll just take a classic design, slap the new year on it, and, you know, call it a new card, which is not extremely innovative. You're just borrowing an old design. But I think Topps did something really nice here, where they took a little bit from the past, incorporated a lot from the present, with a look towards the future. And another big reason why I love the 2019 design is that it's different from 2018 and 2017. I like the 2017 Topps. 2018 Topps was okay, but it was just too much like 2017. Like, they really didn't think it out much more than they had to. 2019, though, is a nice, nice look. And I'll also suggest, if you take a look at the back of the cards, I think you'll like those too, because especially nowadays, you've got so much data that you can put on the back of a card. I don't think Topps overdid it. You know, you look at a couple of past base sets, and it's like they're just trying to cram in not only statistics, but narrative and, you know, players' Twitter and Instagram handles and all this other stuff. And I think they balanced it out just right. It's a lot easier to read. So 2019 Topps, a must buy. I do really enjoy that set, and I will be buying more of that than I did the 2018. And I know when the base set came out, what was it, January 30th or 31st? I wasn't out the first day it came out, but I bought some on the second day and brought some home and, you know, got a couple fat packs and sat there on the couch with my son. We opened them up and, you know, looked at all the players and the, you know, different team cards that we got, the inserts as well. And what I loved was, here's my 9-year-old son, without any prompting, he goes, "Well, we can trade some cards." And you know, if you're a longtime collector, having your own kid go, "Hey, Dad, we can trade some cards," I mean, how cool is that? So you know, we actually didn't make any trades, because as I went through the cards again, I went, well, I don't have any Rays or Marlins cards. Those are his two favorite teams. So we didn't actually make some trades because I didn't have anything to give to him. But that was a very, very cool moment there. So, Gord, like you experienced with your dad opening up a box of cards and kind of going back in time, I got to experience the thrill of it now. And, you know, hopefully looking forward, hopefully 30 years from now, my son's doing the same thing with me, and we're continuing to enjoy the hobby. So again, thanks for sharing that, Gord. And also, thank you very much for chiming in, Barbara. Great picture, great story. And like I said, it got a lot of reaction. So I know that a lot of fans are looking at that and going, "That's awesome. I've experienced that." And I hope, you know, a lot of other children of yours, or if you're younger and your parents are still alive and you still want to collect, you can, you know, still partake in that. It's amazing the connection that one piece of cardboard can make. And quick side story, you know, talking about that card show that's here in Tampa, there's a great dealer, really nice older gentleman that I've been buying a lot of stuff from. He loves it when kids come to his table and he gives them, you know, what we call junk wax. He calls the kids pack. So, you know, there's a little plastic bin of all sorts of 88 Fleer and 90 Donruss, you know, the packs that, you know, you normally wouldn't buy. He'll just give them to kids. "Here, take three packs and, you know, thanks for coming." And it's a really smart thing to do. But he had an off cut, and I mean like way off cut, 61 Topps Willie Mays. And I mean, you can't sell this, you know, nobody's going to buy it. So he just had it sitting in a box somewhere. And he gives it to my son and he says, "All right, you got to take this home, and your homework is the next show you're at. You got to tell me who this is." So, you know, I tell my son a little bit who Willie Mays is. I show him, of course, the legendary basket catch in the 54 World Series. And my parents came over to the house for our kids' birthdays. My son and daughter were both born in the month of January, just a few weeks apart. So, you know, we kind of have a combined family celebration for the kids, which, trust me, when you've got two kids who were born in January and it's right after Christmas, the checkbook needs a universal one-stop shopping family birthday party. Yeah, February is a pretty dry month around the Salmon household. But anyways, you know, I got the card and I said, "Hey, go show this to your grandfather." And you know, my dad grew up in New York and got to see Willie Mays in his prime in the 1950s, and of course still followed him when he was out in San Francisco. After the Dodgers and Giants left New York, my dad and his dad would occasionally take a train down to Philadelphia and you know, through a Phillies game, would watch the Giants and the Dodgers play. Of course, you know, my dad's a Dodgers fan. He wasn't going to go watch the Yankees. So, get on the train and go to Philly. Let's watch some real baseball, right? So, my dad was, happy even just for a couple minutes to talk about, you know, the Say Hey Kid and, you know, how special of a ball player he was. So, again, just one piece of cardboard bringing together generations at once. I think that's really, really cool. A couple of quick comments from DMs, and I won't bring up this person's name because I actually didn't ask him if I could carry out our discussion on here. We've done this before, but I will bring up one point. He said, you now love the Ted Williams set. We're talking about the 59 Fleer set. And whether or not you're ready to admit it, you're going to start building it. My response was, well, perhaps, but I won't go out of my way to get them. And that's the truth. And, you know, keep in mind when we talk about the 59 Fleer Ted Williams set, and I said once, not that long ago, I said, well, it's kind of a boring set. Again, I'm thinking of why it was not a huge smashing success when it happened. And that's, again, if you were a 10-year-old child in 1959, unless you were a Red Sox fan or a Ted Williams fan, why would you want an entire set of Ted Williams baseball cards? You wanted all the players. You wanted all the stars. You wanted Willie Mays. You wanted Mickey Mantle. You wanted Hank Aaron. You wanted your favorite local team, whatever that may be. So that's where boring came from. It wasn't necessarily the set itself, but that's how it was received. Now, because it wasn't received so well, and because it was in limited numbers, because Topps challenged Fleer and had them remove one of the cards that was in the set, you know, over time, people realized the scarcity of the set and there was some value to it. And I think older people, as time went on, and of course, as the legend of Ted Williams grew after his playing days, then I think people came back to it and went, oh, well, this is actually pretty good. And as I mentioned in our last podcast, even the odd card of the three that I had, where it's talking about the 1,300-pound black marlin that Ted caught, I thought that was actually kind of interesting. It's just like, you know, again, a 10-year-old in 1959 could care less about Ted Williams fishing, but you look back on his career and you see this odd card and like, oh, that's actually a pretty weird but interesting tidbit in the life of Ted Williams. But I won't go out of my way for it, but you know, if I find some in a 3-for-5 bargain bin like I did, then I may pick some up, but I'm not going out of my way to complete that set. After all, I still have plenty of junk era wax sets that I'm 10 or 15 cards shy of completing, and I just haven't gotten around to doing it. Another comment, and I did get permission from Robert Lawson to talk about this. He did originally send the conversation through DM, but he said, check out my A Haunted Game Twitter account, and I did. I encourage our listeners to follow along. Again, it's A Haunted Game. That's all one word, no underscores, no symbols, whatever. He says it's mostly baseball stats, but at the beginning of each month, I tweet a photo of my baseball card binder. I didn't previously own any SSPC cards, but after you mentioned them on your podcast, I looked into grabbing a few on eBay, so thanks for the heads up. SSPC did a great job of offering a true alternative to the Topps design. It's too bad that legal issues stopped them from flourishing in the marketplace. And he sent me a lot of pictures of the set, marveling in particular at a picture of Carlton Fisk. But if you do follow A Haunted Game, you'll see a couple of these binder pages that Robert put out there. And, you know, SSPC is kind of like the Ted Williams set. You know, I learned a little more about it, too, in the conversation of our program. And, that's something where, again, I'm not going to go out and try to complete the set or bring in a whole bunch of them like you did with your purchases. But it is something now that I'm aware of. And if I do see some SSPC cards, particularly the winter of 75-76 set that we were talking about, I may look into actually buying that card, whereas prior to doing that little segment on the podcast about it, I may not have even given much thought to it. So, Robert, I'm glad that we were able to give you the heads up on the set, give you the interesting notes on the story behind it as the alternative, the more throwback alternative to the more glitzy cards of the mid-70s. And even though the legal efforts of Topps did snuff out SSPC and their dreams of providing a more simple, cleaner heritage set, if you will, featuring current stars, as I mentioned when we were talking about SSPC, that was part of the legal mountain that was working against Topps in the mid to late 70s. And we'll talk a little bit about that with our conversation about 75 Topps minis in just a little bit. Now, if you have any comments, feel free to jump on board our Twitter timeline, again, at Wax and Gum Stains. We always appreciate pictures you share, stories you tell, questions you have. If you want to talk about any of the sets we discuss, any of the players that we talk about, you're more than welcome to do that. It is open 24/7, and you never know, sometimes your comments and questions will be featured in our podcast. Now, I always mention that we also are keeping our bank account open, if you will. The Wax Ecstatic PayPal account is open. If you would like to make a cash donation, which helps benefit of this program, you can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic. I'm appreciative of all donations that have been made. And when I say donation, even if it's $5, and we've had plenty of those, that's perfectly fine. Thank you. If you want to give more, if you've got 10 or 20 bucks you want to give, great. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And as I always say, any contribution that comes in through the PayPal Wax Ecstatic account, that goes straight back into the program. Number one, keeping the program alive and well on our home base at Audio Boom, which allows us to send it out to all the other ways that you can listen to the show on iTunes and iHeartRadio and TuneIn and Stitcher and Google Play and Spotify and all the other various channels that just latch onto the RSS feed and send it out there. So that's one thing, maintenance. It keeps the new shows coming and it keeps the archives alive, but also it allows me to go out and purchase some of the cards, whether it's single cards or packs that we discuss on this program. So please know that any money that you send, it's just not going into my back pocket. It is going back into the show. So you are investing in the show, much like David Moody did. David's a longtime listener, and he not only made a cash donation, and I thank you for doing that, David, but I want our listeners to thank David because, as I threatened in the last podcast, if I didn't get any cash donations, I was going to open up the 89 Bowman pack, which I still have. I'm looking at it. It's right over here on the shelf, just to my right. So again, I'll use the Oral Roberts style threat. Instead of, if you don't give me money, God will take me. If you don't make a donation, I will unleash the terror of 89 Bowman on you in the next program. Some of you may like that. You're masochists, though. I like that. But most people don't like it. So again, if you want to chip in a couple bucks, we'll keep the 89 Bowman at bay. We will not release the Kraken that is 89 Bowman. But along with the donation that David made that not only spared you from 89 Bowman and keeps our program going, David brought up five comments, actually. And they're all great. Thank you very much, David. I'm actually going to start with the fifth one and then go from comment 1 through 4. And in this program, we will address comment points 1, 3, and 5. Okay? 2 and 4 we'll save for other programs. But let's start point number 5 here, his only quote-unquote gripe. I feel that you too casually refer to a card you found at a show as, quote-unquote, not a PSA 10, but probably a PSA 7 or 8. Do you realize how exacting PSA can be? Yeah. And David, I guess I'm just an eternal optimist. No, actually, I do know how exacting PSA is, and we've discussed it in past shows. In fact, two or three episodes ago when we were talking about the value of vintage cards, part of the reason why the price tag on some vintage cards is less than what you may have paid, say, 20 or 30 years ago for a vintage card is part of the graded marketing because they are so exacting. And it's not just PSA, it's BBCE, it's Beckett, it's everybody. Because it's so exacting, and if you get that really, really, really anal retentive guy at the end of his shift going, meh, it's a four, it drags down the value of your card and kind of depresses the market a little bit. If your card is under, say, PSA 8, PSA 7 is slightly higher than the average book value for an undergraded or an ungraded card. And, if it's under 7, it's very hard to find resale value for it. So I'm totally aware of how exacting it is. I am just very casual. This is just naked eye looking at the card. Obviously, I'm not sitting there with the magnifying glass and looking for, little threads or these microscopic printing errors or this slight little smudge inside this one little statistic on the back of the card or any irregularities in the cardboard itself, how it was processed or a tiny little bubble in a picture. It's all just naked eye viewing. So if I casually say, maybe it's a PSA 8, I realize if I work for PSA, it's maybe a 5. But, my point is that instead of throwing around the terms, and here's one of the good things about the grading system is that it gives you a more exact description of the value of the card. It's easy for us to rate something on a scale of 1 to 10. Whereas if I said a card is in very good condition, well, very good can mean a lot of different things. Very good or excellent or near mint. Everyone's definition is different, where I can tell you that a 9 is higher than a 5. So when I say that it's, I may not be calling it gem mint, or I may not be calling it very good or excellent, but it's just my guess at what kind of condition it is. But I am an eternal optimist, especially when it comes to baseball cards. All right, the other points. Point number one, do not be shy about asking for donations. Every listener should kick in a few dollars every couple months. Can I get an amen? By the way, listeners, you didn't thank David for saving you from the 89 Bowman, so I want you all to say it right now. Thank you, David. All right. Thank you for doing so. I don't like to beg, but we are kind of doing a little form of entertainment here, and at least most good entertainment isn't cheap. Now, point number two, and again, this is something that we'll discuss in a future show. It's time to do a show on the Topps Living Set, or at least a 20 to 30 minute segment. Touched up on Topps Living a while back when it first started. I've got mixed emotions about it. We'll save it for another show. Point number three. All right, so I lied. We're going to talk about points 1, 4, and 5 today, 2, and 3 for later shows. Point number three, I'd love a segment about the famous 1989 Topps auction in New York City, which was conducted by Guernsey's. I know a little bit about that. I need to just dive into a little more about the history of it. I've read about it. I'm aware of it. I want to dig in a little more as to how the whole collection was amassed, how it was sold, why it was sold. So give me some time. We'll eventually dive in to that. And then the question or the comment that David brought up that helped drive this particular program. And like I said, I actually have a couple of these cards and was intrigued myself by some of the points he made. I'd enjoy a segment about 1975 Topps mini cards. Why did Topps produce minis? Where were they sold? How many minis were produced compared to the regular size cards, etc.? Well, David, great questions there. Great comments as well. Thank you very much. And, your questions actually kind of made me scratch my head and go, yeah, I know about the Topps mini set, but I never really dove into all the facts and figures about the Topps mini set. So what can I learn about this? And I recalled, I've got some Topps mini cards. the Darrell Evans of the Jerry Kuzman. I went into my binders and dug them up, took a couple pictures, posted them on the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed. So if you haven't seen them yet, I posted them alongside a Robin Yount rookie from the base set. Now you'll see that the Yount rookie it's a little beat up, so I had no trouble just popping that out of a page that I had and putting it on the little backdrop that I have and taking pictures. Funny story about that Robin Yount card, real quick. And speaking of local card stores, so when I went searching for local card stores a couple years ago, there was one in nearby Clearwater. And when I say nearby, it's not exactly a direct shot from where I live. So, you know, again, you kind of have to make a trip out of it. And this particular store is kind of small. No, correction, very small. Didn't have a whole lot of baseball cards that I was interested in. And I happened to show up on a rainy day where I was the only customer in the store. And that's a terrible position to be in because the guy behind the counter is kind of lurking. Are you sure I can't help you find something, sir? No, I'm you know, overwhelmed by the shelf and a half of stuff that you have here. So I had to do it. I just because I felt bad, I had to buy something. So for, you know, $10, I bought this somewhat beat up Robin Yount rookie card. And I'm not going back, but okay, I did my duty for them. But anyways, I took the base set 75 tops card and I flanked it with the Kuzman and Evans mini cards. And as I'm looking at the mini cards, I'm just racking my brain going, why did I buy these? And I've said before, even when I was a teenager and just starting collecting in the late 80s and early 90s, because of my love for the history of the game, I would not only buy the new cards, but I would go out to flea markets and hobby shops and garage sales. And if somebody had a box of cards from the 60s and 70s, I would buy those up. And I'm trying to remember where I got these from. I know for a fact that I bought these probably around 1990, and I think I bought them at a hobby shop. It was just one of those hobby shops that had binders and binders of old cards, and I think I found a couple of minis in a bigger binder of mid-70s cards, and I think I kind of looked at them, and I went, oh, those are neat, and I knew who both players were. So I bought them, and I know I didn't spend much on them because, again, I was probably 13 or 14 years old. So I might have spent a dollar a piece on them. I don't know. I really don't remember. But over the years, you know, they went into a binder page, and they just sat there. I have no idea specifically when or where or why or how I bought these particular cards, but there they are. They're just sitting in a binder, and what do you know? David asks about the 75 Topps mini set, so here they are. So I don't have some great story behind these, and it's kind of it's driving me crazy because I normally have some interesting story behind every card that I have, but these, they just ended up in a binder many moons ago. So that's my story and I'm sticking to it. But the 75 Topps mini set is a very interesting set because it was brought about for a couple of reasons. One was the mounting lawsuits that Topps was about to face, as we were talking about with the SSPC set. And two, as they like to say in politics, it's the economy, stupid. And in 1975, or going into the 1975 sales window, so think about this. This would have been probably the summer of 1974 when plans are being put into motion as to what kind of products Topps is going to put out in 1975. And remember, 1974 was the first year that Topps made a one-series set where they released the entire series all together and they got rid of the individual series. And the main reason why they got rid of the individual series is because as what we call the high number series. So say series 4, 5, and 6 of a regular season set, they often went undersold because stores still had series 1, 2, and 3 cards laying around, so they weren't buying series 4, 5, and 6. Also, as society was adapting football as the main game of the country, well, as football season's coming around and people are losing a little bit of interest in baseball season, the appetite to buy the cards as a consumer was less and less. And Topps is looking at this going, well, we're losing money on these higher number series. And the wholesalers are looking at their purchases with Topps and they're going, yeah, we're losing money if we buy these high number cards because they're just sitting in warehouses and we can't sell them. So for economic reasons, Topps decided to release the entire set, all 660 cards, at the beginning of the 1974 baseball season. And of course, they got bitten on the rear end by the San Diego Padres, who were all but certain going to move to Washington. But of course, Ray Kroc comes in, saves the day, and that's how you end up with the Washington National League cards. I believe there's 15 of them. I might be wrong with that number, but there's still, several Padres players who are identified as Washington players in the 74 Topps set. And, Topps was kind of stinging from that, but because of the economy, they decided to keep the one series plan going, and they would do so up until 1993. So the economic reasons actually started a year prior. So again, maybe summer of 73, going into the 74 season, they have the one series set. So let's again go back to the summer of 74, where you've got Watergate at full gale force effect. Nixon is days away from resigning because he's about to get leveled in the impeachment process. You've got gas lines, you've got the OPEC crisis, you've got inflation going on. You have all sorts of political and civil unrest. It's, you know, if you thought the 60s were crazy, the 70s, everything was just unraveling in America. And with that goes consumer confidence as well. So Topps in the summer of 74 is going, all right, what are we going to do in 1975? Well, we're going to keep the one series set for the base set. Okay, great. But they decided to explore some other options. And that included creating a miniature size set. And not just miniature in terms of the size of each card, but the size of the set as well. The overall set was actually a little smaller than the base set. So Topps puts out this small set, and it was small in just the size. The actual design of the card was the same. You know, you had the same color palette, which was very colorful in 1975. You had the same design on the back. I mean, this was literally a mini-me set of the base set. Now, the bigger differences, though, were some of the cards in the set where you had special highlight cards and all-star cards and team checklist in the 75 mini set that you didn't get in the base set. So it's not an exact replica that was miniaturized. There were some subtle changes to it. But basically, in all intents and purposes, the 75 Topps mini set was basically the mini-me of the base set. So they did this not only to offer up a unique and somewhat less expensive product for the consumer, but for Topps, this was a win-win because they used less cardboard because the cards were smaller, but also because they made the set smaller. The way that they printed the sheets of the baseball cards, there was going to be a lot less duplication, a lot less of these short print cards, because the way that they were going to cut the cards, it came out to a precisely matched number. You weren't going to have those doubles floating around and the short prints as well, just because you had to fit X number of cards on a sheet. So the consumer gets to save. They get a set of baseball cards and they're able to, you know, Topps is able to keep the suggested retail price down with the smaller card. And Topps also saves money because they get to create a smaller set in terms of the individual card size, but a smaller set too in terms of raw materials, the cardboard and the ink and the packaging and the shipping to get all of this out there. This is not all that different. If you remember about 10 years ago, different products, not baseball cards, but just consumer goods, in particular soda and bottled water. And you still see this to this day, even though the economy is doing much better now than it was, say, 10 years ago. But you saw, like, Coca-Cola, which normally has a 12-ounce can, because of the economy 10 years ago, people were buying less soda. They were trying to save money. Coca-Cola didn't want to put out, you know, all of these 12-ounce cans and lose money because they're sitting on store shelves. So they put out the 8-ounce can, and you have these little miniature cans of soda. Same thing with bottled water. You know, the size of ice cream, you know, some makers of ice cream, instead of the traditional half gallon, it's 3 or 2/5 of a gallon. I don't know the precise size. But anyways, you know, the makers of certain food products shrunk the product down just a little bit to not only save cost on their end, but to keep the price point for the customer at about the same. That's exactly what Topps was trying to do in 1975 with the mini set. You could say, hey, we've got a set of baseball cards for you. They're a little tinier than what you're used to, but yeah, they're still baseball cards, and Topps kept their price down. The consumer could still afford it at whatever price they were paying for packs the year before. So you would think conceivably this would be a win-win situation. Now, what Topps did with this product was they tested it primarily in Michigan and California. Now, I say primarily because while the shipments may have gone out to Michigan and California, because of certain wholesalers and because of certain buyers, sometimes the product spread out a little bit. So they may have sent a lot of it to Michigan, but if you lived in Illinois or Ohio or Indiana or Minnesota or Wisconsin back in the day, perhaps there was a grocery store in town or a hobby shop in town that had these mysterious mini cards in their store. Same thing in California. Even though a lot of these went to Northern California, if you lived in Oregon or Washington or Nevada at the time, you may have found a dealer or a, you know, regional grocery store chain that also carried these. So that leads to the question, well, why Michigan and California? Well, think of this. In the mid-1970s, Michigan was still a prosperous industrial blue-collar state. They did not have the population woes. You know, the people were not fleeing Michigan with the demise of the auto industry that we've seen over the last 20, 25, 30 years. They were still holding strong in the mid-70s. Now, as we all know, it would teeter in the late 70s, and it's, you know, gone in its downward trend since then. But Michigan was still very populous, very blue-collar, great baseball fans, and a pretty trustworthy market of the, like I said, the blue-collar, 9-to-5 union family audience. That was your core audience in Michigan. California, you also have industry. You also have a populous area, but California in the 70s was growing. Where Michigan may have been stagnating a little bit, California was definitely growing, especially the northern parts of California. This is right before the first tech boom of the late 70s and early 80s, the very beginnings of what we know as Silicon Valley these days. So California was booming. California was more suburban as well. And you had a lot more baseball teams there and a different type of sports fan, a little more of a leisurely sports fan, just because of the climate and because of all the options of what you can do with your spare time. where with Michigan, if you wanted to enjoy baseball, you could only do it basically May through September because it started to get bone-chilling cold in October and it stayed that way in April. California, of course, you could do these outdoor activities pretty much 11 out of 12 months out of the year because they do get a little chilly in certain parts of California. So I thought that was interesting that they tested that in Michigan and California. Wouldn't be the first time or the last time that Topps did that. The next best experiment that Topps did in Michigan and California, the tamper-resistant packaging on the 83 Topps set, which you can still get, they call them the Michigan packs, where it's basically a plastic wrap that you couldn't tamper. And strangely, Topps didn't stick with that. They stuck with the traditional wax system up until, you know, Upper Deck and Score stole their thunder in the late 80s, and then Topps would do a more tamper-resistant packaging in 1992, or 1991, rather. But they tested it, and the test market was kind of a mixed result, really, because a lot of people who bought this weren't quite sure what to make of the miniature set. It's not that they hated it, they just didn't know what to make of it. In some markets, because minis flooded the market, that's the only type of set that collectors knew back in the day. And you also had some collectors, hobby dealers, who would buy up hordes of these cards from wholesalers. And I mean cases and cases, a warehouse full of these mini sets. And they would store them away knowing that because this was a test product, there may be some value in hanging on to these for 40 years or so and then trying to sell them. So Topps didn't exactly get the desired effect they wanted. There was kind of a lukewarm response to the product by fans. There were hobbyists who were storing cases of the product away, so it wasn't really able to disseminate much. And it wasn't exactly a resounding success. It wasn't a failure. But Topps could see in 1975, okay, there's just really not much of an audience for this. So they decided to do a couple of things. First of all, as the 70s went on, the cardboard stock got a little thinner, a little flimsier. And you'll notice this when you look at cards from 77, 78, and 79. Even though they look the same, there's a slight thinness to the depth of the card. So those cards are a little more prone to the wear and tear than what you could put a Topps card through in, say, 72, 73, 74. So that's how they reduced a lot of the cost. Also, Topps would distribute the packs in different quantities. So you had a 2-card pack, you had a 10-card pack, you had an 8-card pack. And that's something that was very common in the mid to late 70s. They didn't really settle in on a 12-card pack until 77, I want to say. I might be wrong about that. It might be 78. But, they experimented with different quantity packs at different prices, so you could still spread the product out there. But if you didn't want to spend 25 cents on a pack of cards, you could still get a pack for 10 cents. You just got 5 cards as opposed to 12. So if you're buying Topps packs from 75, 76, 77, you know, make sure you do a little homework. And there's a lot of resources out there, especially 76 Topps. If you're looking to buy unopened packs, do a little research, look at the wrapper. There are clues in the wrapper as to what type of pack you're getting. A lot of times when you go online, somebody will just say, I've got a 76 Topps pack. And the bidding is going as if it's the full retail pack when it's actually like a 5-card pack. So make sure you do your research on what you're potentially buying. You don't want to pay $85 for a pack of cards that only has just a few cards in it. You want the full deal there. So that's how Topps combated the economic issues. And as the economy continued to stumble throughout the 70s, there were still enough options for consumers, and Tops was still able to save some money and still offer a product at a price point that was beneficial to the consumer and the company as well. Now, David, you asked about the 1975 Tops mini set. What's the ratio of mini sets to regular sets? I don't have the exact number, but again, because the mini set was a test product, there is a perceived higher value to the individual cards and complete sets that are out there. But with that said, there are still actually quite a few mini cards and sets and packs available to consumers nowadays. And why is that? Well, it's because of those hobby shop owners who over 40 years ago just stored cases and cases of these away. Well, they've been since auctioned off or released by, you know, estates. And I don't want to say they flooded the market, but it's very odd. If you go on eBay and you type in 1975 Topps baseball wax pack, for every 10 packs that come up, by my searches, probably 7 or 8 of them are mini. It's harder to find the base set packs than it is to find the mini packs. Now, that's not to say that the mini packs are cheaper than the regular base set packs. They're just a little more plentiful because, again, a lot of those were sitting in warehouses for several decades and then finally, over the last 10, 12 years, have been released to the general public for sale. So if you're looking to collect the mini cards, you're in luck. There's actually quite a few out there. And again, because what was going out there was a smaller number than the base set, the value of the individual cards is higher than the base set cards. And because 75 Tops has so many great cards, you've got the Yount rookie, you've got the George Brett rookie, you've got a lot of star players like Mike Schmidt and Pete Rose and Johnny Bench and Tom Seaver and Nolan Ryan. You've got, you know, anybody who was a star in 1975, they have a mini card in here. And again, because it's slightly different than the base set, there is a little bit of uniqueness to the card. You've got some unique cards. You've got some incredible rookie power in that set. And you also have a lot of early career cards for some of the stud players in the 1970s. And you know, you think back to, you know, some of the players that I named, but you also have, you know, Thurman Munson. You've got late career cards for Brooks Robinson, Frank Robinson, too. Of course, he was managing the Cleveland Indians at that point in time. Steve Garvey, you've got, you name it. There's Carlton Fisk. There's just a lot of star power in that set. So even though the set was limited in production compared to the base set in 1975, because so many were stored away by collectors and then later released, there's actually, I would say, more accessibility to unopened 75 Tops mini cards than there are regular base cards. And of course, because the mini set was treated just like the regular set, and you didn't always have serious collecting habits in the mid-70s. A lot of these cards, maybe they didn't end up in bike spokes, but they had rubber bands around them in shoeboxes. The quality of the card, the condition of the card, was often suspect. So if you're able to get something fresh out of a pack now, that's going to add some more value to it. And of course, the dual color fronts to the 75 top sets made getting gem mint condition cards or PSA 10 cards nowadays a lot harder because with kids slapping rubber bands around these cards and carrying them around in shoe boxes, you not only had the creases and the wear on the edges, but also you had a lot of the shading, fading of colors, the chipping of colors with that full color front from the 75 top set. So in short, there were fewer Topps Mini cards that were released. It was a test product, but because they were heavily protected by several key hobby buyers at the time, nowadays there's actually more accessibility to the mini cards than the base set. But again, you're still going to pay a premium for the mini cards. But still a very interesting set, brought about for very interesting reasons. Topps looking for a way to keep producing their cards to reduce the cost that went into producing and sending these cards out, offering a consumer a, I don't want to say cheaper, but a still viable, valuable expense. You know, they could keep the price point the same in 1975, despite a slightly smaller product. And also, I forgot to mention this, but this does play into the legal challenges that Topps was going to face, not only from an SSPC and the TCMA guys, but most notably from FLIR. This was right when FLIR started its long, drawn-out battle with Topps. That would last until the summer of 1980. And Topps needed to look at their product and go, okay, how can we not only save some money for us, save the consumer some money, but how can we innovate something? Because they knew, had the Topps mini set been a success, Topps could have, had they chosen, could have continued to release several or two different sets, the full size base set and the miniature set. And that would have been something unique and different than what FLIR or eventually Donruss could have done. So there was a little bit of innovation in the decision to produce a mini set, but it was mostly for economic reasons, not only for Topps dealing with tough economic times, but for consumers and collectors as well, as the value of a dollar was really stretched in the mid-1970s. So a fun look back at a very unique set, 75 Topps Mini. It has actually pushed me to consider buying an unopened pack if I can find one for a decent price. And yeah, you know, the next show I'm at, I'm going to look for some mini cards, and if I can get them at a good price, I may add to my collection. One other footnote to the miniature craze, Topps would come back to not a miniature set, but a micro set, as they called it. They did this in 1991 and 92. I have actually seen full factory micro sets on sale. Because they're part of the junk wax era, you can get them at a very good price in most cases. But you can still see those for under $10. You can get your 1991 or 92 Topps micro set. Now, even though there were economic challenges in the early 90s in America as well, not only for makers of products, but for consumers as well, that was more of a part of the glut of the hobby. Topps saw an opportunity to create something unique, and it did harken back to the mini set experiment in 1975. But that was really just the hobby was in a full boom in the early 90s, and it was really just an opportunity to market something else for collectors to buy. And this was also the time that Topps was creating the Bazooka cards, and Bazooka had some mini cards in their bubblegum packs. And it wasn't necessarily in the pack. You would buy a box of Bazooka gum and you could get some miniature cards, which I had. I think I still have. They're floating around somewhere. But there was a micro, I don't want to say a craze because it really wasn't a craze. It was part of the bigger baseball card craze of the early 1990s, but there were some micro cards produced back then, and they are a lot easier to get now and a lot cheaper to get. So if you want to experiment with the smaller than normal size baseball cards, you may want to check out the 91 and 92 mini sets or the micro sets first, because that is a much smaller investment than anything that you will have with the 75 Topps mini set. So quickly, let's talk about the two players that I have cards of, Darrell Evans and Jerry Kuzman. And we'll start with Evans. As I mentioned, Bill James calls him the most underrated player in baseball history, and that is hard to argue with, as Darrell Evans playing much of his career with the Atlanta Braves, but also playing for the Giants and the Tigers and wrapping up his career with the Braves in 1989. He was the first player to hit 40 home runs in a season in both leagues. He had 41 for the Braves in 1973, and that was a homer-happy Braves team. It's too bad the Braves really didn't have any consistent pitching, because the team might have been a little better than they actually were. But you had Hank Aaron, Darrell Evans, and a surprising power season from Davey Johnson that year. And Evans led the way with 41 home runs in 1973. And then in 1985 with the Tigers, he had 40 home runs as well. He had 414 home runs in his career, over 2,000 hits as well, 22-23 in hits. A career batting average of .248. He did strike out a lot. His defensive game was not spectacular, and he is often overlooked. In fact, probably just on the strength of his home run hit numbers, should be in the Hall of Fame, but he has been left in the dark with that for, unfortunately, ever since then. But what's amazing is when he retired, he and Reggie Jackson were the only players to have hit 100 home runs with three different teams. And that is amazing, because we know that a lot of his career was in Atlanta, but he was with some bad Giants teams in the late 70s and with a world championship team in Detroit in 1984. Different leagues, different ballparks, different types of pitchers to hit against, yet he was still able to accomplish that. Not only was he a World Series champion in 84, but his 40 home runs in 85 led the American League. Two-time All-Star in 1973 and 83. When his career was over, he went into coaching. Minor league coach in the Texas League, Texas Louisiana League in the late 90s, longtime representative of the Golden Baseball League in California, a manager, a director of player personnel, had a fingerprint on the Golden League, the California Winter League for a long time. Also, he was a key person in one of the early online baseball sim games. You may recall Ultimate Baseball Online, also known as Cal Ripken Real Baseball. That was the first free, open access, multiplayer online sports game, which you have plenty of those now. And there are other games, you know, real Ripken Real Baseball and the Ultimate Baseball Online game ceased to operate, I want to say 2010, somewhere around there. But you've had some offspring ever since then, as gaming has really grown over the last few years, especially multiplayer gaming. But you had games, you know, the baseball mogul games back in the early 2000s. Now a game that I love to play, Out of the Park Baseball, or OOTP, which is a spectacular sim game if you haven't played it. You know, you've got those options right now, but Ultimate Baseball Online was the first free game. It was an open source game, and, you know, unfortunately, you do get what you pay for. And even though Ultimate Baseball, later Ripken Real Baseball, while it was a very good game, there has to be an investment from the user to continue to grow and you know, innovate the online game and maintain it as well. So that died a tough death there. But Darrell Evans, very much still involved in baseball, be it in online gaming or out in California. His nickname, by the way, I love this. He was nicknamed Howdy Doody. And if you don't know the Howdy Doody show, that was a kid's show back in the 1950s. Google up an image of the Howdy Doody puppet and compare it side to side with Darrell Evans, and you can see the likeness. There is a similarity there. Also, Darrell Evans, a very interesting trivial tidbit here. If anyone asks you who was on base when Hank Aaron hit home run number 715, off of Al Downing on April the 8th, 1974, it was indeed Darrell Evans with Dusty Baker in the on-deck circle. And the other player, Jerry Kuzman, you know, I always had a soft spot for Jerry Kuzman because I thought he was always overlooked in the history of great Mets pitchers. always overlooked by Tom Seaver, but also Nolan Ryan. And Nolan Ryan was the one who got away from the Mets. Yeah, you know, people, you know, they look back at Ryan's, you know, handful of years in his early days in baseball, and they forget about Jerry Kuzman. You know, Kuzman won 222 games in his career, was part of the 69 Mets, the Miracle Mets, a key part as well, despite getting shelled in his NLCS game against the Atlanta Braves, came up with a big win in Game 2 of the World Series to even the series 1-1 with the Baltimore Orioles. And he pitched a complete game in Game 5, despite giving up an early 3-0 lead. The Mets were able to rally, and he was the guy who, you know, completed the deal, and the Mets pull off the incredible upset in 5 games at Shea Stadium. A great story of how Kuzman was discovered by the Mets and how he was almost lost. So Kuzman was discovered by the son of a Shea Stadium usher. Kuzman was in the Army. He was stationed in Fort Bliss, Texas. And the catcher for Kuzman was the son of the Shea Stadium usher and said, hey, you got to take a look at this guy. He's left-handed. He's got some good stuff. So the Mets signed Kuzman to a contract. He was about to get cut in 1966, but Joe McDonald, the assistant farm director, suggested to the front office, hey, let's hang on to Kuzman because he owes us money. Jerry Kuzman borrowed money from the Mets because his car broke down en route to spring training in 1966. He hadn't paid them back yet. So Joe McDonald says, hey, let's deduct some pay from his next paycheck. We need to keep him on the roster. So they keep him on the roster. They got their money back. And in 1967, Kuzman leads the International League in strikeouts. And the rest, as they say, is history. As in 1968, he becomes a regular in the Mets rotation, goes 19-12, 7 shutouts, a 2.08 earned run average, 178 strikeouts in the season. Those were actually franchise records at that point. This is right before, actually right after Tom Seaver set those records. Of course, Seaver would overtake a lot of those records, but Kuzman was an all-star, was runner-up to Johnny Bench for Rookie of the Year, as I mentioned, a key part of the Mets in 1969. Also, their World Series appearance in 1973. He was a runner-up to Randy Jones for the Cy Young Award in 1977. Now, the bottom drops out for the Mets at that time. Of course, Seaver gets traded to Cincinnati. The Mets are going through a full-on rebuild. He requests a trade, and he gets sent to the Minnesota Twins. Now, what's interesting is, in that deal, the Mets acquired Jesse Orozco, who would be a part of the 86 Miracle Mets as well. Kuzman in 1979 goes 20-13, has a respectable 1980 season, later traded to the Chicago White Sox, where he had a rough 1981 season, but did fairly well in 82 and 83, was part of the White Sox resurgence. They got to the playoffs in 83, as you know, and he would wrap up his career with the Phillies. Very interesting footnote to Jerry Kuzman's career. If you've ever had the trivia question thrown at you, who was the pitcher who gave up Pete Rose's 4,000th career hit? It would be Jerry Kuzman. Interestingly, the former Philly Pete Rose, now a member of the Montreal Expos, getting that hit off of Jerry Kuzman in April of 1984. Now, unfortunately, Kuzman, his story ends on a rather unfortunate note, as he pled guilty to misdemeanor federal tax evasion after failing to pay his federal income taxes in 2002, 2003, and 2004. Now, he admitted to being suckered by anti-tax rhetoric. You hear people, they go, well, I don't like the federal government. I'm not going to give them my money. Well, the IRS is not very pleased with that thinking. So they were able to rack up Jerry Kuzman, and he actually served time in federal prison. He was sentenced to 6 months in prison in 2009 and served his time in early 2010. But amazing, Jerry Kuzman, often overlooked, and I think in terms of the hobby, why he's overlooked, he's the other guy on the Nolan Ryan rookie card. So when you have to share space with another legendary name in baseball, that's another reason why you're overlooked. But like I said, I've always had a soft spot for Jerry Kuzman's career because he, 222 wins and, Cy Young award-worthy seasons and Rookie of the Year award-worthy seasons and a World Series champion. He was really an outstanding player and two-time All-Star as well in 1968. And 1969. So don't sleep on the career of Jerry Kuzman, despite his legal issues later on in life. He and Darrell Evans certainly deserving a little more of the spotlight when you're looking back at some outstanding players from the mid-1970s. And they're represented well on this outstanding and unique set, a miniature version produced by Topps. So thank you again, David, for sharing that question and those comments. And like I said, the other comments about the Topps Living set and the 1980 Topps or 1989 Topps auction, we will address a little more in future shows, I promise. Like I said, I've got to come to terms with the Topps Living set. I'm not totally sold on it. I get it. I like the idea. It's a brilliant business decision by Topps. I just haven't been totally bitten by the bug. And I've got a friend of mine who's dropped a few of these living cards on me, and they're nice. Haven't totally bought into it, but we'll discuss that in some other show. And like I said, I've got to do a little more research about the 89 auction, but I do know a little bit about it right now, but I don't want to just wax nostalgic on that as I don't have the full details. I've got to brush up on my history of that in just a little bit. Well, that'll wrap up our show this week. Thanks again to David for the topic, the other comments. Thanks also to Gord and our DMers who are sending me some notes as well. A lot of great conversation going on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And again, moving forward, we will do this show every other Friday, noon Eastern release. So the next show will be coming out on Friday, February the 22nd. So make sure you tell a friend about Wax Ecstatic, please. Tell them to follow Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Tell them to favorite our podcast. Go ahead and save us. Subscribe it if you're listening on iTunes or iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Spotify, you name it. We're out there. Audio Boom, our home base. You could do that as well. Don't forget, too, if you listen on Audio Boom, just take the URL address, add .mp3 to it, and that will enable you to download it and save it as well. And again, your donations are appreciated. They go right back into the program. You can make your donation at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Be like David. Come up with some great topics. Give us a few dollars to make it happen. And save yourself from the 89 Bowman wax pack or rack pack. I'm going to hang that over your heads. 89 Bowman rack pack. It's going to be there. I'm going to threaten to use it. It's the cyanide pill. It will be swallowed if you're not careful. I'm Matt Salmon, your host of Wax Ecstatic. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.